This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makokotlela. Welcome, Lions.
Dumela, Gary, and Dumela to our podcasters. And it's so great to be in studio today and seeing your lovely face.
Well, thank you, Lions.
I wonder what you've got in store for us, music-wise.
Well, you listen up to this one, Lions. Today, we're discussing the duties of company directors. And there, we think about Steinhoff, EOH, MultiChoice, Eskom, obviously, and they've put a spotlight on this very topic. So we're going to unpack how company directors can face criminal sanctions if they fail to perform their duties, and also how delinquent directors can be forced in their personal right to cough up. Hoos, my see, and hoos, as they say in Afrikaans.
Yeah, hey, they are coughing. It's flu.
Yeah, I don't know why doctors hold your testicles and ask you to cough during a physical. I believe it's done in the army as well.
You know what is so funny? It's that if the minister just coughs, everybody catches the flu in terms of the board members. So this is quite a very relevant topic.
Yeah, lads, I believe that doctors kind of hold you because they want to check if you've got a hernia or not. That's the way to test it, yeah.
Serious?
Yeah, absolutely. So I believe. Today we'll also discuss, lines, those directors of companies, and this is very prevalent, that dump their company into liquidation and thereafter they open up around the corner. A similar business, and they give the middle finger to frustrated creditors.
But that's
it
should be unethical.
We're going to talk about how they get away with it or try and get away with it, and what a creditor should do to prevent that. Also, here's a nice one. Can you record a meeting you have with your director, with your HR person, with your whoever in the company? Can you record that meeting? And that's really interesting in law.
I'm very much interested in that because it's kind of very tricky.
Our guest today, attorney Emil Myberg, has been with us a few times. He recently wrote an article about delinquent directors and how they can be held personally liable. And this was published. This is very special. It was published in the attorney's magazine, De Rebus, which I read regularly, monthly. And here's the result of that. Emil got the following reply. Your article, Emil Myberg, Holding Delinquent Directors Personally Liable, which was published in 2017, has been chosen as the winner of the 2017 LexisNexis Prize for the best article contributed to De Rebus by a practicing attorney. That's some accolade. Applause. Well done, Emil.
Thank you very
Outstanding.
Much, Gary.
These attorneys, our attorneys in South Africa, are constantly writing articles. Some get accepted, some don't. Of all the ones that got accepted, yours was the best of the year. Yeah, that's something special.
Thanks very much.
That's about holding directors personally liable, delinquent directors, we call them.
Yes.
Let's start, Emil, if we may. And Lions, we haven't given out our contact details, and you're waiting anxiously for that one.
Very much.
Yeah, you can do the Twitter handle.
Yeah, it's law, HURTZLAW. And you can also like our Facebook page. You'll give the Facebook page details. But more importantly, you can always just give us any topic that you would like us to talk about, and we'll get you a specialist like the one that we have today. We always bring the best of the best. This is the show with a swag, after all.
The Facebook page is The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg, and today we collaborate with Legal Talk South Africa. They have now a membership of, I don't know, it's nearing 180,000 or so.
Wow.
It just goes
great.
Up every week. You're scared to look because it may run off the pages. Well done to Ray Green. You also, Emil, happen to be an administrator of Legal Talk South Africa.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start with a question, in fact, that we got from one of the members of Legal Talk South Africa. It comes from Francois Fenta. I'm going to give his full names. He wrote it about a week ago. He says, if I liquidate the company, will it affect, it should be, the director's credit score? That's one part of it. And then the question is, can directors be held liable for the company's debt? Can directors be held liable for their company's debt? And unfortunately, there was only one comment, and the comment was so wrong that I don't even want to mention the person's name because it's so embarrassing. The person replied, according to the Companies Act, the directors of a company are jointly and severally liable for the debts and liabilities of the company, only in very extreme circumstances. But as a matter of course, Emil, directors are not liable for the debts of a company.
No, they are not. The Companies Act, worldwide legal personality, provides a certain protection against claims. The shareholders, directors, and officers are, as a rule, not liable for the debts of a company.
Obviously, otherwise, why form a company?
Yes.
And one of the very reasons when you go into business, you ask your accountant or your lawyer, please form a company for me. Why do you do that? It's to protect yourself in case things go belly up.
Yeah, that's why some countries call their companies limited liability companies,
yes,
because that's exactly what it is. Your liability is in principle limited to your shareholding.
Otherwise, Emil, you would trade as Gary Hertzberg, trading as whatever, right?
Sole trader.
Johnny's panel beaters.
Yes. You'd go in mum and pop shop.
Absolutely. Yeah. The reason that I don't trade as such, and I'll give you another answer, another example. You send your driver to deliver goods, mm-hmm, and he has an accident. He smashes into a Porsche or a Ferrari, and the damage is 4 million rand.
Mm-hmm.
You, as the employer, are liable,
yes,
for the debts of for the actions of your employee if it's within the course and scope of his employment.
Yes.
Therefore, you as the employer would be liable for the 4 million rand. If you are within a company, then the company's liable,
yes,
and the owner of the Porsche can't sue you or take your house away.
Yes.
He can only sue the company.
That's actually a very good example because, yeah, someone has lost 4 million rand, the owner of the Rolls Royce. The other day I did see an accident between a Ford Kia and a Rolls Royce.
Who came off best?
I'm afraid the Rolls Royce, but that's only physically. Now, it's quite justified for the director not to be held liable. But if that director went and defrauded somebody for 4 million rand, then he can be held liable.
Mm.
And that's the big difference. You know, many people think that they can automatically go after the directors of a company if they suffer losses, but that's not the case.
Mm.
Businesses often go bad. The economy turns down and people all of a sudden don't have money anymore. You know, you can't go and sue a director just because his business has gone bust. But if that director has defrauded you, or if he's traded, or she's traded, like the Companies Act says, recklessly, with gross negligence, with the intent to defraud any person or for any fraudulent purpose, then yes,
okay,
you go after you.
We're going to come to that in detail about reckless and delinquent directors and bad guys, right? The average poor director who starts up a freshly startup company with the best of intentions goes bankrupt, goes insolvent. And the percentage of new companies that go bust is astronomical. Am
yes,
I right?
Yes.
I don't know what it is. It could be as much as 70% or something.
Yes.
Hardly many survive.
Yes.
New companies.
After I started my firm, when I reached my second year, I realized, yeah, hey, I survived the first year, part of the 30%.
So I think the advice we give before we go on is please try and protect yourself. If you start out,
yes,
please form a company.
Look, directors shouldn't become desperate and worried all of a sudden.
Mm.
The mere fact that the business goes bad and is liquidated doesn't mean that the director itself will be held liable.
Yeah.
However, I still remember very vividly the words of my company's law lecturer at university when we discussed personal liability of directors under the old Companies Act. And he had a very dry sense of humor and said, the reason why this is done is because of original sin. He used the Afrikaans word, ons erfsonde.
Mm.
Because people get greedy, you know. A company, a director deals with other people's money, and it's easy money, it's easy pickings. You ask services, you buy goods, you get it, you get paid, you don't pay the supplier. That's the kind of conduct that the Companies Act prescribes. The guy that just has bad luck because his business dries up and gets liquidated, it's unlikely that he or she would be held personally liable. Mm-hmm. But there's a caveat to that. The moment you see your business going bust, then red lights should flag. If you know you don't have money, yet you carry on as a director to contract services that you know there's a very good chance you may not be able to pay it, that could very well fall within the conduct of carrying on business recklessly or with gross negligence. Because you don't know whether you're going to be able to pay them.
We'll talk about all that in detail. Let's, Lange, you wanted to ask something now.
Yeah, because this is quite an interesting question. But doesn't the law also look in terms of what the circumstances were before they call what they what it's called piercing the veil? Because some people tend to use the companies to protect themselves so that they steal money from people and say, but you were not dealing with me directly, you were dealing with a jurist
person. Absolutely, it's a great question.
When does the court come into play to say we are going to be piercing the veil, basically protecting the director from actually dealing with the debtors directly?
Well, if you are the creditor and you want to hold the director personally liable, you will have to make out that case already in your summons. The procedure is you sue.
Don't give away too much now, because we're going to go into all these in detail. Okay. Let's go back a few steps. You have a client, Emil, who wants to start out. He's got a great idea. He's got a good product. He comes to you, says, do I form a company or don't I? And we've already discussed the protection a company does offer him. The other question is, it's very expensive to form a company. It costs you a few thousand rand to register it. And then you need every year to keep it going. You've got to pay, you know, to your auditor and whatever to keep to check the books and all the rest. If you're not going to deal in anything that can land you into trouble, it may not be in your interest, and I say this very hesitantly, to form the company. And maybe just carry on in your own name. There's nothing wrong with that. Because ultimately, when you form a company and you take leased premises, the landlord's going to ask you to sign surety.
Yes, and that will negate much of the advantage given by legal personality.
Yeah. So it's not a blanket rule when I say, please make sure you form a company. It's generally the rule, and there's exceptions to everything. And it may well be, if you're just going to develop some kind of IT product, you don't need to form a company for that. It is so darn expensive. If you feel you're not going to incur any liabilities along the way, you may just want to just trade as whoever. Lionel Makoka, Makoka clearly trading as IT solutions.
I think for sole practitioners, there are limited advantages to forming a company, especially when most creditors are going to ask for a personal surety in any event. Mm-hmm. But the moment you start going into a partnership, two, three, or four shareholders, then it starts making sense. Mm. Because then you spread out the risk over more people, and the fact that you have a company, you know, will make it a lot easier if one wants to pull out. You don't have to renegotiate all the agreements that a partnership, an unincorporated partnership, would have. Mm.
Lawyers don't form companies. They're not allowed to form the PTY.
No.
So you'll find there are lawyers that have incorporated, which is a bit of a company, but the lawyers are still personally liable.
Yes.
They can't get out of that. Lawyers are liable for whatever they may do.
Yes, I think it makes very little sense for a sole practitioner to incorporate, because part of the MOI has to state that the director does not that he assumes personal responsibility for all of the debts of a company.
Yes. Okay, now let's move on to Lionel's question, which was a very good one, piercing the veil. Let's talk about the directors that are ordering goods, or the companies ordering goods from a supplier, at a time when they probably realize, should realize, that they will not be able to pay the account when it becomes due in 30 days' time. There are directors in those scenarios. There are directors that also trade recklessly without due regard. Tell us a bit about how you can nail a director who is trading in those circumstances.
Well, so the facts would be the supplier renders goods or services to the company. He sends his invoice, doesn't get paid, begs to pay, nobody pays him, and he or she eventually goes to see their lawyer. And the advice that I would give in a situation like that is, okay, we sue both the company and the directors. And standard summons, you know, they goods were sold and delivered, the price was such, the agreement was concluded between these people represented by XYZ, the terms were such, and then you go after the directors by saying that when they hired or bought these goods, they knew that they wouldn't be able to pay you.
I think the wording is there was no reasonable prospect of them being able to pay the creditor.
Yes.
That's it, yeah. Isn't that quite hard to prove?
Well, it would be deduced from the facts.
Yeah.
You know, the invoice hasn't been paid for 180 days.
Yes.
Now, what am I to deduce from that? You know, there's no dispute about the quality of the goods. They're not paying.
But what you've got to show, Emil, is that when the director bought, when the company bought the goods, the director then at that very point knew that there was no reasonable prospect that the company would be able to pay it back.
Well,
that's the test.
Yes. Yeah. You would make that allegation in the particulars of claim.
Yes.
And then there's no way to show what he had in mind at the time. The
well,
director.
I guess you would have to subpoena his bank account.
Yes.
To show how much money he had in his account. You'd have to call for his management accounts to see how the business or the company was trading at the time, how much he owed, who he owed it to, all those kind of questions, and what customers he had for those goods. And or whether he was just reckless or fraudulent.
Yes. Well, the first question I would put to such a director under cross-examination is, you know, when you hired these goods or purchased these goods, and you knew you weren't going to pay it. And that in itself is reckless. You knew you didn't have money to pay it. And in addition, I would say that was fraud. You know, hiring or acquiring any goods or services without having money to pay for it, that could very well constitute trying to defraud the creditor.
I've been in these matters, many of them, where the director says it's untrue. I honestly, genuinely, with all my heart, believed when I bought those goods that we'd be able to pay it. We were doing really relatively well. We had a few customers, and then things turned, and et cetera, et cetera. And he comes with a long sob story. It's quite hard because there may be merit in what he's saying.
Yeah, that's why I said earlier, you know, the mere fact that the business is going, that it's going badly with the business, doesn't necessarily make the director liable automatically for the debts of the company.
Mm.
But you know, when things are starting to go bad, the directors will have to start exercising much more caution, you know, saying, listen, we need to buy this, but we don't have money. My advice under those circumstances is don't do it, because you are going to have a tough time under cross-examination to explain why you weren't reckless or trying to defraud the creditor. And it's not just fraud, you know, reckless, that means you're not paying the due attention to the business that you should. Fraud is much stronger than reckless. Reckless just means you're not doing what you should.
Fraud, I agree with you. There are many occasions where a company buys, they go belly up very soon after they've bought the goods, and then a month later you find that they've opened up under another company name down the road with the same bloody goods and the same machinery bought back from the liquidators. It drives creditors crazy.
Yes.
I mean, well, you've had clients and I've had clients that can't take this.
Yeah, that's why we have this wonderful insolvency inquiries. Now, the provisions of the old Companies Act dealing with insolvency inquiries are still in force.
Yes.
In terms of the new Companies Act. So if there are liquidation proceedings and the directors and shareholders start transferring goods from one company to the next, leaving an old company with all the debts, then you have a Section 417 inquiry, Section 424, and you go after the creditors. You go after the directors. Because there are several transgressions of the Insolvency Act there as well. Transferring the whole or most of substantive part of the goods of a company.
Mm-hmm.
The case law on that is quite clear. I can't really imagine anybody being able to get
away with
that.
Makes common sense if a company is moving their stock out and then shoving it into a new concern, which it opens down the road. That's an obvious.
Yes.
There's something that is often thrown at creditors by directors when they get sued, and they say, why did you supply me the bloody goods? Why didn't you check? You saying that I traded recklessly, you should never have supplied me.
That's the oldest excuse ever.
And if you'd gone to an industry meeting with other creditors that supply me, you would have seen that I'm not paying many people.
blaming the creditor for your own shortcomings.
You know what they say, Emil? They say if you can't pay someone what you owe them, don't have a sleepless night. Let him have the sleepless night.
But that's a relevant question because in most cases, also if you are a credit provider and you grant credit to someone without actually doing due diligence, that's reckless lending, and that should be your own problem because at the end of the day, you should have done your homework.
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay.
No, we're not talking here about credit. We're talking here about somebody about a contract.
Yes.
Faith underpins our law. If the fact that you should not have trusted me becomes a valid defense against a claim, then I think the whole economy is going to collapse.
Mm.
One has to have some faith in somebody else's ability to comply with a contract. A contract is nothing other than giving somebody your word that you will do what you say you but what you undertake to do. So by saying that the onus is on you to make sure that I can pay it, that won't fly.
Well, just if I can take that a bit further, the argument raised by directors as well, they say, you, creditor, you are greedy and you are desperate to do sales. And you should have checked before you supplied me whether I could pay you or not. Did you check? I know you checked me out when I first applied for credit 2 years ago. Have you been checking me out every month? Do you check out whether I've got judgments? Do you do other searches on me to see whether I'm paying others? You don't.
That is good common sense. And many companies do that. They do credit checks on companies to see if
constantly
these companies are credit worthy.
Yes.
But once again, I don't think the fact that somebody hasn't done a credit check is going to be a defense. They can certainly come and say, look, you know, you didn't exercise enough caution when you supplied me with the goods, or you were very desperate in trying to sell me this. I mean, that's a defense that I think would only work if the debtor is a natural person. You know, but if a big company...
Well, the director is a natural person, and he's the one you're trying to nail.
Yeah, but
you're suing him. You're saying, I'm going to hold you personally liable because you're the thief. And he says, but you're greedy. And so the argument goes.
Yes, I think, but directors are held to a higher standard than ordinary mortals.
Absolutely. I think the answer is, what I'm trying to throw here is that creditors should also be careful.
Yes.
We can't just extend credit. Even if you think the company is good, it may have been good 2 years ago or 6 months ago, it's not that great now. The problem is, often the creditors are the smaller guys. We're not talking of the tiger brands. We're talking of the little guys who, 20,000 loss to him and 50,000 rand loss could knock him out of business.
Yes.
What should he do? Do your homework. You know, just keep checking every time you supply, every month. Make sure that... that and you are supplied to someone who will pay you.
And ask for deposits. I mean, in the legal industry, as you well know, you hardly take on a client without asking for a deposit to be covered in the case that the person can't pay you. And that in itself is already an indication of whether the person would be able to pay you or not.
You know, lawyers get away with that. We all do it. Lawyers that, unless you act for a big brand, but if you act for the man in the street, you do ask him for a deposit.
Yes.
In commerce, it's going to be darn hard for the little, for the supplier to ask the panel beater, please give me a deposit. I'm going to supply you parts. Give me a deposit. You say, do me a favor. You want a deposit? I've got 30 other creditors that will supply me without a deposit. Because South Africans, a business is desperate today. People just want to supply. They just want to supply. And what I'm saying here is that don't be desperate, because you're going to get yourself into trouble, because there are a lot of sharks out there that want to take your money.
I've had that thrown at me. And I have said, listen, then you're welcome to go and choose one of the other suppliers. I'm not going to take this risk.
Yeah. If you don't want to give me a deposit, go to some other lawyer and see whether he'll do it for without a deposit.
Exactly.
And he, 9 times out of 10, won't. I think it's kind of common that we take deposits.
Yes.
For the person in the street, really. Not for big business, obviously.
But, I mean, when was the last time you asked, you know, a plumber to come out to your house and they didn't ask for a deposit? You know, they all ask for, I had to have some repairs done to my swimming pool recently, they asked for a 60% deposit.
Yes.
And the reason for that is, you know, as much as I say that faith underpins the economy, blind faith is also extremely naive. You've got to accept that some people just not want to pay, and you've got to cover yourself against that risk. And that 60% deposit I had to pay was paying the price for other people who don't pay and who can't be trusted.
So you paid the 60%. It's unlike you, Emil. I thought you would have turned it down. Must have been a good supplier. What about the, on that note, I mean, the electricians and plumbers and all the rest that come to your house daily, they take the risk of not being paid?
Yes.
The other side of it is that the person that's receiving the service is generally a property owner.
Yes.
So if they don't pay, any plumbers or electricians that are not paid that are listening, take the buggers to the small claims court. They shouldn't get away with it. Even for your 1,000 rand. Yeah.
Without mercy. I actually, with this guy that came to repair my swimming pool, it's a pensioner. He and the pal of his, the pensions don't cover all their monthly expenses, so they've gone into this business.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a long chat, and he eventually told me, you know, that of all things, it was an attorney who told me that he told me that didn't pay his bill.
Wow.
And I said to him, but why don't you sue him in the small claims court? I explained the whole situation, all the procedures to him. I said, you're getting some free legal advice here. Go after it. The risk is zero. We've spoken about the small claims court here in the past.
100 times, yeah.
You know,
and yet people still don't do it.
Yeah. The worst you can get that can happen to you is you can lose, but you don't get a cost order against you.
Yeah. We go on about small claims court. There used to be another show on another radio station. There was a famous doctor on it. And people used to phone in. I don't want to mention his name. He was great. People phoned in with all kinds of ailments, sore tooth, sore nose, sore foot, whatever. And the question, the answer he used to give each one of them was, stop smoking. But doctor, I'm phoning about a sore toe. Stop smoking. And so we say, go to the small claims court.
Yes.
The same advice. Go to the small claims court. But it's got nothing to do with that. Go in there. Any claim under 15,000 rand, you can go to the small claims court.
Yes.
Even if your claim is more, you can abandon the more and go for the 15,000. Yes.
And I will repeat what I've said here. I would go to the small claims court for up to 25,000 rand. You abandon the 10,000 because you would spend more than that on legal fees anyway. You walk away with 15,000.
Yeah, you don't. And no lawyers are allowed. So you can't get a lawyer, even if you want one. A lawyer can help you put the papers together in his office, but you don't need to do that.
And,
so
and I often do that.
Yeah. Do you?
I do, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so Emil, let's get back to our directors. Now, let's talk about our big companies. Well, let's talk about Steinhoff and people, EOH and the multi-choice, people that are taking strain at the moment.
Yes.
What's the law there?
Well, the law is essentially the same, but of course in a big company, not your incorporated mom and pop shop, there are often, you know, these non-executive directors for being a director is a career. They're directors of several companies, normally listed companies. And they are not that active in the day-to-day management. They leave it in the hands of committees and whom they trust. They have a CEO who takes care of the day-to-day running of the company. Yeah, just to find out later that the CEO and other members of the company have been defrauding shareholders and investors massively. And now they're coming after the
directors.
These directors that were not taking part in the day-to-day running of the company. The immense risk of that, you know, look at Steinhoff. They're being sued in Germany. There are class actions coming up against them in the United States. And any big listed company that has investors all over the world, here in South Africa, talking about South African companies having investors from abroad, defrauding creditors are looking at serious litigation against them, class actions in the United States.
Yes.
And those lawyers are not, they take things very seriously. You've incurred losses through reckless trading, through defrauding shareholders and creditors, as is prohibited by Section 22 of the Companies Act. And they get sued in the United States for millions. And I think that's coming this way in South Africa as well. But I think these non-executive directors have to take special care. There are some defenses allowed for them in the Companies Act. They can rely upon professional opinions.
Well, what happens to a director? You're a non-executive director. You don't work every day, but you're on the board and you get the financials every week or every month. You receive financial information from departmental managers. Can you rely on that? I mean, what should you do? And is that a defense to say, but that's what I got, that's what they gave me, that's the best I could do?
That is a defense. But I think it's only going to be a defense up to a point. You know, could you really have trusted that person? I think it's a defense that will probably succeed in most cases.
Yes.
So listen,
honest. I was honest and it was reasonable.
Yes.
I think that's the wording.
You know, we got
for
an
me
opinion
to
from senior counsel. Yeah. You know, or we got statements from one of the big four audit companies. I think in that case it would fly. Mm. But these non-executive directors have to be very hands-on. I don't think they would be able to rely solely on the opinions or information that they get. They would have to at least ascertain for themselves that everything is above board.
When is a director delinquent? That's the article you wrote. What is a delinquent? I know delinquent child. What's a delinquent director? Everyone wants to know that one.
Well, a delinquent director is somebody that has been declared as such by a court.
Mm.
There's a whole procedure that you have to tick off in the Companies Act. First, you have to show that the director acted recklessly with intent to defraud somebody, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then, if you manage to hold him or her personally liable, and the Companies Act does prescribe certain standards of conduct, then that director must be declared a delinquent director. That's in other words, a director who has not lived up to the standards imposed by the Companies Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the penalty for a delinquent director is that he or she can be prohibited from acting as a director, either in general or for a specific class of companies, for up to 7 years.
Kan hy tronk toe gaan?
They can go to prison as well, yes. In addition to being held personally liable, there are a director defrauding somebody can be imprisoned for up to 10 years.
Mm.
And the appeal court has expressed themselves on this in a case that was reported last year, the Giwala case. And I'm very sad to say that the appellant in that case who lost is a former colleague of ours. He was an attorney as well. And the court made it very clear that he was held to a high standard. In addition to being a director, also being an attorney who should have known better.
Yes.
But the court has said that, you know, directors deal with the investing public, and the penalties prescribed and the standards set out in the Companies Act is good enough to deal with this kind of action.
We also, Emil, have the Corruption Act, which is POCA, P-O-C-A. It's, the full title is Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. That one provides that any person who holds a position of authority and who knows or ought reasonably to have known or suspected that someone's committing a fraud or has committed a fraud in an amount of 100,000 rand or more must report that suspicion. And if he doesn't, then he's in trouble.
Yes, I think 100,000 rand is not a lot of money.
It's not. So if you know someone in the office that's diddling something and you turn a blind eye and you say, I don't want to get involved in this, you're in trouble if you reasonably ought to have known.
Although I think the catchphrase, the catch word there is the position of authority.
Yes.
You know, I think nobody's expecting of colleagues to rat on each other.
Yes.
But if you're a director or an officer or
yeah, somebody, he's got to be in a position of authority.
Yes.
If your boss, if you're working for an SOE and your boss has done something wrong and you know about it, you're obliged.
Yes.
Absolutely. Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
So what's going to happen to Lynn, Malusi Kigaba, for example? What's the chairperson of SAA, because she has been stated as delinquent.
Well, we know what we'd like to happen to these people, whether it happens or not.
Well, there has been an application to declare the former chairperson director of SAA a delinquent director. What's happened to it, I don't know.
Yeah. Can you record a meeting with a director or anyone within your company?
That's one of the questions that pops up most on Legal Talk.
Yes. And I'll tell you why it comes up. The director's a bullshitter. Promises, doesn't deliver, all kinds of stuff. You know, you just can't trust him. So you want to go into a meeting, put your recorder on, and record the meeting without him knowing about it.
Yes, and if you look, there are so many apps. I've got one on my cell phone here where you can record a
yeah, we're recording you now.
Well, this is with my consent. Look, the rule is if you are taking part in the conversation, then you are allowed to record it without advising anybody. And when I say taking part in the conversation, it means you must be one of the people talking. It doesn't help just sitting quietly in the corner. You have to be one of the participants in the conversation. There are some other requirements as well, that it shouldn't be for an illegal purpose. But the general rule is, you know, you can record it.
Can I ask this question? We have a meeting in private and you tell me that within a month you're not going to be getting a job, but then you go out in the media as my boss and you say something which is contrary to what you said in private. Am I allowed to really publish, let's say, the letter that you sent to me in the media, for example? Would that be regarded as okay?
Well, my question would be, why would you want to do that? Why?
Because you stated something that is inconsistent with what you told me on paper. This is what you said to me, but then when you go out into the media because you want to protect the goodwill of your company, you say something else as opposed to the truth that you told me.
Yeah, I think Emil's question was great. Why do you want to publish it in the media? Do you want to embarrass someone? Because Lines, we know you can't do that. You can't go and embarrass anyone. If you want to use it for your own purpose, yes, absolutely.
But I'm a brand myself too. Yeah, so I want to protect the goodwill of my brand to simply say, but that's not what you said. This is what you said.
To him. You want to use that against him. You want to record the call or use the letter that you have, of course. That's your right.
Now look, if you're suffering damages, so if the person has lied to you and now you're suffering damages, then obviously you can use a recording to say, look, you are not being honest. You are now embarrassing me. You are causing damages to me. And this is not what you said during our meeting.
Okay, so let me just give context to this, because this has just actually happened on Sunday, where one of our veteran actresses was actually canned from a TV show. And the owners of the production said something. But then in like last year, 3 months ago, they stated something on paper. And she just brought their letter and she published that in the media.
Yeah, I suppose there's nothing wrong with that.
I don't think so. But, you know, 3 months is a long time for things to change. You know, they may have made a promise under certain circumstances 3 months ago. Then circumstances changed.
I think it's one of those that depends, Lani.
Yeah, no, it depends.
It depends. It could be things could have changed in the last 3 months. You've got to be very careful there. Yeah. But I guess.
I have a problem with the whole thing of somebody recording my conversation with them without actually informing me that they are going to do
this. It happens every day. You're going to meetings, you're being recorded. If you are party to that discussion, you can be recorded. Lawyers, whoever it may be.
But shouldn't you say, I'm going to record this for my own benefit?
I think there's something the Law Society, just as an aside, I think they've got some rule that if you want to record a colleague, if I talk to Emil about a matter, I have to tell him I'm recording you. I may be wrong there. It used to be like that. But if you go into a meeting with anyone and you party to that, the law doesn't prevent you from recording it.
I have personally a bit of a problem with the whole prohibition on recording because, you know, we all take part in meetings all the time and I make notes. Mm. What is the difference between making written notes during a meeting and recording it?
Absolutely.
You know, so I can say, listen, I wrote down that you said to me you would do this. Yeah. I can use that. So I recorded you. Here's your voice saying you would do this. Mm. Now I can't use it. Why not?
You go into a meeting. Everyone's got the cell phone on the table.
Yes.
Okay. What do you think they're doing? Half of them are recording you and the other half are waiting for their girlfriend to text them.
Yeah. It's only fair. Yeah, it makes sense. But I guess maybe if you just disclose it.
There's no necessity. That's
okay. Yeah. Look, I think it's probably common courtesy to say, listen, I'm going to record this.
It's more like you're conniving type of person.
You know, we've become so sophisticated in the world today that people can maybe write as fast as you can talk. So does it, I mean, if I don't record you, but I can write fast and write down every word you say, I'm recording you.
Yeah, no, I guess you've got a good point.
Yeah.
I'll withdraw my submission.
No, but it's a valid submission. You know, there are lots of people who have exactly that same question.
It is slightly dishonest if you don't tell someone. But then you can record someone on the phone, you know, you've got everything. If you're on the phone with someone, you can record them. Yeah. You can even take their emails if they're on the server. You can get their emails.
Ooh, I guess. Yeah. It's tough.
I mean, if you're using the office's system and you're writing to your girlfriend or boyfriend in your case lines, it can be used. That information's on the server. It's there. It's not on your personal computer. And so be careful what you write.
Employment agreements almost come with a standard clause to say that you have no privacy in relation to use of company products or company equipment.
It's lovely. I love these discussions. Here's one. It's a post that was on Legal Talk. I'm going to read it. It's a bit of an old one, but it's happens a lot. A director of a company has debts. It's his own personal debts. And his creditor has obtained judgment against him. Can the creditor get his hands on the assets of the company for which he works and in which he has shares?
No. But the creditor can try and attach the shares of that director if the director has any shares.
So whatever assets the debtor has can be attached. And yes. If he's got shares in a company, that's an asset, can be attached like anything else.
But if the director doesn't have shares in the company, then you can't go after the company.
There's a whole thing on sureties that I want to deal with. We have like 10 minutes left.
I wonder if I should do it. Latin phrases, you know, non numerata, pecunia, things like that.
I'd like to maybe keep it, Emil. I'm going to keep that for another time. And we'll spend more time on sureties because there's so much on sureties.
Yes.
How you get out of it, how you get into it, why, wherefore, etc., that we won't do it justice in 10 minutes.
No.
So if you don't mind, come back. We'll put it as a second segment to another show and we'll talk about sureties then.
Yeah, that sounds good.
On the director's level, Lions, are you cool?
I'm very much cool with that, but I just think maybe people need to be more informed and do their own researches insofar as the challenges that they might be facing in this area.
There's one question I want to ask you, Emil. It's on the credit CPA. And we've done it before, but I love this one. May your doctor charge you for an appointment you have missed? If anyone's missed this before, here's the answer.
Section 17 of the Consumer Protection Act says that you are allowed to cancel advance bookings And I think that applies as much to your doctor as it does to schools.
Holidays,
yeah. I mean, how often have you been at doctor's consulting room where, you know, your appointment is for 4 o'clock, they can only see you at 5.
Or 7.
Or 7 because they are so busy.
Yeah.
A doctor can only charge a cancellation fee if, despite all reasonable efforts, he or she couldn't find somebody else to take your slot. And knowing how busy doctors are, I think it's going to be a tough time for a doctor to come and try and sue me for R1,000 for the consultation because I cancelled half an hour before the time.
I think the HPSCA, Health Professionals Council, frowns upon this.
They do, yes.
And they don't allow doctors to charge for a missed appointment. Same with a lawyer, same with anyone. I mean, if you miss your appointment, he's kept that time for you. It's aggravating, isn't it?
It is. It's certainly annoying because suddenly you're not making that money. But at the same time, you know, the advocates have got a very privileged position. You know, if the trial collapses, then they're still entitled to their fee. And that caused a lot of annoyance amongst my clients. But, you know, even we can't really or won't really charge for a missed appointment. I certainly won't charge a client who cancels an appointment. You've got a long-term relationship with that client. It's happened to me this year a few times. Clients cancel meetings, but then they come back later. You know, I'm certainly not going to ruin a relationship with a client that's been a client of mine for several years because he's cancelled one appointment.
There's a great story about a senior counsel, a very eminent senior counsel. When he passed away, they tell the story. He arrived at the pearly gates and he was asked, how old are you? So he said, I'm 87. They said, no, you're not. You're 170 according to your billings. There you go, lads. That's on that note, we're going to end the show. Many thanks to Emil Myburgh, to Lionel Makoka-Clela, and especially to you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm sure you've enjoyed it as much as we have presenting it. Until next week, see you then.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.
This is cliffcentral.com.